Texas oil refineries released hundreds of thousands of pounds of pollutants, including benzene, carbon monoxide, hydrogen sulfide, and sulfur dioxide, into the air as they scrambled to shut down during last week's deadly winter storm, Reuters reported recently. Winter Storm Uri, which killed dozens of people and cut off power to over 4 million Texans at its peak, also disrupted supplies needed to keep the state's refineries and petrochemical plants operating. As they shut down, refineries flared or burnt off gases in order to prevent damage to their processing units. According to the Texas Commission on Environment Quality, the five largest refiners emitted nearly 337,000 pounds of pollutants in this manner. ExxonMobil's Baytown Olefins in Baytown released 68,000 tons of carbon monoxide and nearly a ton of benzene in what it called the safe utilization of the flare system. Critics noted, however, that benzene is harmful to bone marrow, red blood cells, and the immune system. There is no safe amount of benzene for human exposure. Sharon Wilson, a researcher at the advocacy group Earthworks, told Reuters. Motiva's Port Arthur refinery released 118,100 pounds of pollutants into the air between February 15th and February 18th. This was triple the amount of excess emissions the plant reported to the U.S. Environmental Protection Agency for the entire year of 2019. Valero's refinery in Port Arthur flared 78,000 pounds of pollutants over 24 hours beginning on February 15th, while Marathon Petroleum Galveston Bay Refinery released 14,255 pounds in less than 5 hours that same day. Hilton Kelly, who lives in Port Arthur, told Reuters that there were 6 or 7 flares going at one time. Wilson said that the flaring could have been prevented by winterizing the refineries. We need someone in the Texas legislature to file a bill requiring the oil and gas industry to thoroughly winterize all their equipment, Wilson told Arthur. The bill probably won't pass in Texas, but that will create some more scrutiny about it. Arthur reports that between February 11th and February 18th, there were 174 so-called emissions events from fossil fuel facilities in Texas, compared to between 37 and 46 such events in weeks before the storm. In addition to the previously mentioned pollutants, chemicals released from Texas facilities include over 6,500 pounds of the carcinogen isoprene from a Shell plant in Deer Park near Houston, as well as an intermediate amount of methane, which is 84 times more harmful to the atmosphere than carbon dioxide over the short term. Wilson told Arthur that in Texas, we don't count methane in pollution reports. The release of large amounts of dangerous pollutants during Uri stands in stark contrast with claims by Texas Governor Greg Abbott that alternative energy sources such as solar and wind are responsible for Uri's deadly power outages, and that the Green New Deal would be a deadly deal for the United States. According to reports, state data showing oil and gas producers were flaring methane this week is just making things worse, and it could have been prevented by winterizing facilities. Texas Oil and Gas Companies filed 174 notices of pollution releases above permitted levels between 11 and February 18th, four times the number the prior week, according to TCEQ data. Total pollution at Houston area facilities during the cold snap totaled approximately 703,000 pounds, about 3% of the total pollution over permitted amounts for all of 2019 and almost 10% of 2018's releases, according to TCEQ data analyzed by advocacy group Environment Texas.
Iran Today.
About 3 years ago, Donald Trump pulled the U.S. out of the JCPOA, or Iran nuclear deal. He subsequently imposed escalating punitive sanctions on Iran. Even the coronavirus pandemic didn't change this. In response, Iran progressively stepped out of its JCPOA constraints on uranium enrichment and other nuclear activities. But Trump's successor is talking of stepping back into the deal, beginning with three gestures. So perhaps Iran will reverse its withdrawal. I say perhaps because talks alone just aren't going to cut it for Iran anymore. Iran has said not enough. The U.S. must verifiably end the whole economic terrorism of Trump-era sanctions, or else it will have failed to exercise due diligence in practicing its international obligations. The leader of the Islamic Revolution, Ayatollah Sayyid Ali Khamenei, has urged that the U.S. and the EU Troika violated all of their JCPOA commitments and therefore don't get to set conditions for Iran. Stay tuned for the latest developments in Iran's nuclear program and Western reactions. U.S. President Joe Biden has installed a new team of diplomats with the task of undoing and repairing the damage done during the Trump era. U.S. violation of the JCPOA is but one of those damages. But the Biden team has been demanding Iran's full compliance to the JCPOA as a precondition to renegotiating that deal, lifting U.S. sanctions on Iranian individuals, removing U.S. objection to an IMF loan to Iran, and facilitating humanitarian trade with this country. There is one thing pressing the Biden administration to make an urgent move. That is a recent law passed by Iranian parliament, the Strategic Act of the Islamic Consultative Assembly to remove sanctions. The act obligates Iran's government to block snap inspections by the UN nuclear watchdog from February 22nd if its partners to the JCPOA did not implement their own commitments under the deal. The aim is to restore balance in parties' commitment to the deal by getting sanctions lifted off Iran. This would ultimately save the deal, which was originally meant to limit Iran's peaceful nuclear program in return for sanctions relief. A letter was sent to the UN nuclear watchdog, the IAEA, by Iran's permanent representative to that Vienna-based organization, Kazem Gharibabadi. In it, he clarified the reasons for the December law. Our guest highlights the important points. Mr. Beheshtipour always has a studied, honest viewpoint to put in. Once a news manager at Press TV, he joined us on Skype.
When Iran saw that it can't trust the American side, it moved towards the implementation of the law enacted by the Iranian parliament. The responsibility for reaching this point rests with the United States, because it can easily return to the JCPOA. If it returns, Iran will also go back to the JCPOA.
Mr. Shadiat Madari is the editor-in-chief of Kehan Daily, a renowned face on the Iranian political spectrum. Let's hear him out.
The point about the additional protocol is snap visits from any place at any time.
That is, they took away all our intelligence. We should not have accepted it at all from the beginning. The inspections have been so rigorous that after the JCPOA was reached, Obama himself said the inspections that were put in place for Iran are a system that is unprecedented in the history of the IAEA. We need to stop our voluntary implementation of the additional protocol. First, it is legal to withdraw, because it was voluntary. And second, it had to be approved by the parliament, which it wasn't. And third, they took all our intelligence. So this is a very important thing that is unfortunately being done with a delay.
Iranian President Hassan Rouhani has, among many voices, urged President Biden to return to the JCPOA and lift all of Trump's sanctions. He said, surrendering to law is not a fault. Do not shy away. What is bad is surrendering to force. Also, in a telephone conversation with German Chancellor Angela Merkel, he said of the nuclear deal, it is a document approved by the Security Council and the product of the long efforts of Iran and the six largest countries in the world. The JCPOA has a specific framework and is unchangeable. It is impossible to enter new topics into the JCPOA. This, Rouhani stressed, in light of the fact that even Europeans have been trying to rewrite the deal to get Iran to namely scrap its basic defenses, its ballistic missile program. Mr. Sadatian is a political expert who served as ambassador to the UK. His insight is that of one who's seen the other side up front.
Now they're making demands beyond what we agreed on, that we do not necessarily discuss at this point. They demand to discuss Iran's missile range and Iran's regional influence. There's a lot to talk about. You have to first prove your goodwill and then come back for talks. But the fact is that Iran has a natural influence in the region. How can they ask us to reduce our influence? We need to stick to the facts on the ground. The Islamic Republic has reached such a point of reliance and strength that it's not afraid of negotiations.
Mr. Ajarlu is editor-in-chief of Mosallah's magazine. Let's hear a word from the editor.
We negotiated and implemented the JCPOA once, and there is no reason to return to it again with preconditions. In our view, the JCPOA is a multilateral agreement in which we fulfilled our obligations but did not benefit as much. What the parliament has done is a clear signal that we're ready to go back to the pre-JCPOA era and even reconsider inspections, and that we can leave aside dealing with the IAEA with goodwill.
So far, the U.S. and Iran have been stuck in a negotiating stalemate. According to some diplomats, disputes about who must make the first step are absolutely counterproductive, and instead, the process needs to be carefully synchronized.
It seems that this step-by-step mechanism, meaning that they take steps and Iran acts accordingly, and takes measures in five gradual steps. In addition to, implementing the parliament's passed law is sufficient and sometimes can be given. It might not be necessary to refuse to allow in the inspectors under these circumstances.
The United States is not in a position to set conditions. It has violated and broken its promise. First, all sanctions must be lifted, not on paper, but in action. Therefore, we must verify it. So, some gentlemen are wrong when they say that we will return immediately after the Western side returns. It is not so. Sanctions must be lifted and we must verify them. For example, we have to be able to do our business, import or export. When we exported our products, the money has to return to the country. Well, this takes time. We have to make sure that the sanctions on the banks are lifted.
To look at Biden's three-step plan to resolve the dispute over the nuclear deal, the U.S. said it would accept the EU High Representative's invitation for discussions with Iran and the five other signatories of the JCPOA, Joint Comprehensive Plan of Action. At the same time, Biden rescinded Trump's claim to have reimposed all U.N. sanctions on Iran via a JCPOA snapback mechanism. Other signatories and the UN Security Council at large had denied the Trump move had any validity anyway, as the U.S. was no longer party to the deal. The U.S. has also dropped special restrictions on Iranian diplomats in New York imposed by the Trump administration, which limited them to the Iranian mission, the ambassador's residence, the airport, and a six-block radius around the UN. They will now be subject to the limits that were in force before the Trump era, a 25-mile radius around Midtown Manhattan.
Now it's our turn. They have played their cards and have no trump card to play. That's why they resort to such excuses. The UN Security Council rejected the snapback of sanctions, with an overwhelming majority of 13 member states voting against it. They want to sell this to us as a privilege. They say they have brought in a woman of Iranian descent to the State Department. This indicates that their hands are now empty.
Both countries have signaled their readiness to revive the agreement since Joe Biden's inauguration, but have deferred on who should make the first move.
I think we should wait for their practical action, not that we should take the practical action. Our practical action was a parliament's law, which I think we should continue to implement. We have to speak the language of the world, and we're doing just that. If we talk to them gently, their demands will become more outrageous.
Iranian Foreign Minister Javad Zarif has previously signaled a conditional openness to talks with Washington and the other parties over reviving the deal. And he appreciated Biden for acknowledging that Trump's UN sanctions claim had no legal validity, but he demanded U.S. unconditionally and effectively lift all sanctions imposed, reimposed, or relabeled by Trump. We will then immediately reverse all remedial measures. Our remedial measures, expansion of Iran's nuclear activity in recent years, are a response to U.S. E3 violations. Remove the cause if you fear the effect. We'll follow action with action. There's plenty more to our narrative, but first, let's give other media outlets a chance to have their say.
Welcome. In today's news section, we will take a look at some of the most interesting topics related to Iran's new approach to the JCPOA and the dispute between Iran and the U.S. Mir News Agency takes a look at China's proposal for the future of the JCPOA. The headline reads, "All parties should push for unconditional U.S. return to JCPOA." In reaction to the recent remarks by U.S. officials about returning to the JCPOA, Chinese Foreign Ministry spokesperson said that all parties should push for the unconditional return of the U.S. to the JCPOA as soon as possible. Currently, the Iranian nuclear issue is at a critical stage, with both opportunities and challenges. China holds that the return of the United States to the JCPOA is the only correct approach to resolve the impasse on this issue, said Hua Chunying. All parties should act with greater urgency, work together to implement the consensus reached at the foreign ministers' meeting last December, and push for the unconditional return of the United States to the JCPOA as soon as possible and the lifting of all sanctions on Iran, she added. Urdu Point News takes a look at Iran's foreign ministry's reaction to the U.S.'s latest gestures for easing of tensions. Here's the headline. Iran studies EU proposal to hold meeting of JCPOA members with U.S., according to Iran's foreign ministry. Tehran is considering the proposal of the European Union to hold an informal meeting between the members of the 2015 Joint Comprehensive Plan of Action, or JCPOA, together with the United States, the Iranian Deputy Foreign Minister Abbas Araghchi said on February the 21st. We are studying the proposal, communicate with friends, Russia and China, on the issue. Following consultations, we will make a decision, Araghchi said during an appearance on TV. The deputy foreign minister added that there was a chance to revive the nuclear deal after U.S. President Joe Biden's arrival to the White House. The Russian Sputnik News informs its readers of Iran's stance regarding U.S.'s recent movements. Its headline reads as follows. U.S. return to JCPOA pointless if sanctions are not lifted in action, Iran's envoy to UN says. While the United States has recently signaled it could return to the Joint Comprehensive Plan of Action, or the JCPOA, no actual steps have been taken by Washington. The United States' possible return to the Iran deal would be meaningless if Washington doesn't lift all sanctions it imposed against Iran first. Iranian ambassador to the United Nations Majid Takht-e Ravanchi said in an interview with Khamenei.ir. According to Takht-e Ravanchi, Washington introduced three types of sanctions against the nation. And, quote, if even one of them is not lifted, the U.S. return, quote, to the Joint Comprehensive Plan of Action, or JCPOA, which former President Donald Trump left in 2018, would be pointless. But that's it for the news section. Stay tuned for our show's main narrative.
How did European signatories to the deal support Iran after Trump's violation of the accord? It is true, Europe has been trying to save the nuclear deal. It did vow to protect Iran's economy against the U.S. sanctions, but none of its initiatives have so far produced a satisfactory result. After the U.S. departure from the nuclear agreement, Europe undertook 11 commitments to safeguard Iran's JCPOA interests in areas such as oil sales, insurance, aviation, shipping, and industrial cooperation, but none have been fulfilled so far. The European signatories to the deal have failed to install a working mechanism that could bypass the U.S. banking stranglehold for repatriating Iran's oil revenues. Who could blame them for trembling at the thought of infringing U.S. sanctions? Trump was a bully.
Now, one can say that the U.S. withdrew from the nuclear agreement. A madman like Trump left the deal, a move which the Americans did not approve of themselves. This doesn't necessarily mean that the Democrats, Mr. Biden, and his team are committed to maintaining international standards and saving their face. Mr. Trump acted like a bully on many other issues. For example, he deactivated Obamacare. He built a wall along the southern border to prevent Mexican migrants from coming to the U.S. He even abolished the NAFTA Pact. He withdrew from so many international agreements. His madness didn't only affect the JCPOA.
Iran fulfilled all of its JCPOA commitments until the U.S. pullout. The IAEA verified this 15 times at least. Let's hear an expert say whether Western parties to the deal fulfilled any of theirs.
The Americans did not commit to what they signed. When we asked the Europeans why they didn't intervene, they said we are a group of private companies that are influenced by the United States. The government here is small and powerless. If the government does not have the power, why did they sign and guarantee the agreement? In my opinion, Europe is completely influenced by the U.S. and can only play a decorative role in the negotiations, or in some cases, promote the U.S. position.
If Iran's experience of the first chapter of the JCPOA is any indication of what might happen in the future, is it logical for Iran to participate in another round of negotiations? On the other hand, could the situation get any worse than it is right now for Iranians after the inhumane sanctions that the Trump administration imposed on them?
We created our own problems. For example, what does unbridled inflation has to do with sanctions? Or what about market liquidity that has escalated multifold? The fact that some people take liquidity to the housing market one day and to the dollar and gold coins market the other doesn't have anything to do with sanctions. We have to think for ourselves. How can they sanction a country with 15 neighbors? So the problem is that many of these problems can be solved if we believe in ourselves. But of course, sanctions also create problems.
Iran will resume honoring the nuclear deal in full only after the U.S. has removed all sanctions on Tehran in a practical and verifiable manner. Because, as Ayatollah Khamenei has said, the domineering order has always looked for excuses against the Islamic Revolution. One day it's human rights, once vilifying theocracy, once the nuclear issue, and once regional issues. They're all excuses. The key concern is that Iran won't give in to their domination. Mere words don't help. This time, only action. A new agreement is possible as far as Iran is concerned, provided it also respects Iran's right to nuclear technology for peaceful purposes.
Negotiation is a diplomatic tool and can never be left out. Negotiations are a tool that can be useful or harmful. If done appropriately, it is excellent and helps break deadlocks like the JCPOA, which was the first international undertaking after World War II to resolve a crisis through dialogue. In this way, negotiations are not good or bad in nature. It depends on what, how and for what purpose we negotiate, and also who are the negotiating parties.
We can't change the subject. The problem isn't what to do to take the U.S. back to the JCPOA. The problem is the lifting of the sanctions. It does not matter to us whether the United States returns or not. Let the Europeans figure that out. The United States has violated Security Council Resolution 2231. Why doesn't Europeans protest? The Security Council must act against it now and issue a resolution. Not only they didn't issue a resolution, they didn't even make a statement or an implicit warning. This is the environment we need to negotiate in.
Reflecting on government obligations with regard to the additional protocol of the NPT, Nuclear Proliferation Treaty, Tehran's decision to suspend voluntary implementation of that protocol would not mean that Iran intends to expel the UN nuclear watchdog's inspectors. The additional protocol allows intrusive inspection of Iranian nuclear facilities, and that intrusion, which allowed in spies and sabotage, is deemed unacceptable. Anyhow, Iranian parliament adopted its December urgency law with its 22nd of February deadline for other parties' recommitment.
In fact, we failed to act during this time. According to paragraphs 26 and 36 of the JCPOA, which deal with the issues related to non-compliance, we had to retaliate immediately after they failed to meet their obligations. We had to stop fulfilling our obligations right away, but we did not do that. We waited so long that Trump left the JCPOA. Their excuse was that Iran's missile industry and Iran's presence in the region should be included in the JCPOA. Besides, they wanted to extend the restrictions indefinitely.
UN nuclear watchdog had Rafael Grossi arrived late Saturday, February 20th, in Iran for talks on the eve of Tehran's deadline for U.S. sanctions to be lifted. This was his second trip to Iran in the past year. Grossi said on Sunday, February 21st, that it had struck a deal with Iran to cushion the blow of steps Tehran plans to take this week that include ending snap inspections, with both sides agreeing to keep necessary monitoring for up to 3 months while Iran stops cooperation with the agency until sanctions are lifted. Meaning that Iran will record the activities of its nuclear sites via the installed CCTV cameras and will store them for up to 3 months. If any desirable development occurs, Iran will hand over the footages to the IAEA, or else will erase them for good. In opposition to this agreement between the administration and the IAEA, the Iranian parliament passed a vote on referring the administration's deviation from the parliament's bill to the judiciary on February 22nd. On the evening of Monday, February 22nd, the same day of the parliament's move, in a meeting with the members of the Assembly of Experts, the leader of the Islamic Revolution stressed his concerns over escalation of such differences, which could be interpreted as divide in the country. The December law obligates the Atomic Energy Organization of Iran, AEOI, to install advanced centrifuges, increase the level of nuclear enrichment to 20%, and halt the additional protocol if the illegal sanctions against Iran are not lifted. Iran insists all these steps are reversible if the parties to the 2015 nuclear deal, the JCPOA, honor their commitments. Iran will remain party to the NPT Safeguards Agreement, although the government is obliged to prevent foreign access and monitoring beyond the additional protocol. In the U.S., the think tanks Atlantic Council and Quincy Institute for Responsible Statecraft have published analysis, which warned Biden to race against the clock to escape the so far dangerous game between Iran and the U.S. Robert E. Hunter, the 1990s U.S. ambassador to NATO, believes that Biden must be willing to take some political heat to break the current standoff between the two capitals. He points to the time as a constraint and recommends the simplest first step would be for Biden, by a stroke of his pen, to reverse President Donald Trump's May 2018 withdrawal from the JCPOA. That would challenge Iran to de-escalate. The expert realizes that U.S. domestic politics, Arab states of the Persian Gulf, and Israel are the main factors complicating Biden's decision-making towards the Iran nuclear deal. I asked for a practical solution to the impasse to relations between Iran and the West.
As long as we rely on independence, in its true sense, and on pure Islam, that is fighting oppression, and the West emphasizes its arrogant nature, both sides remain opposed to each other. This conflict will end when one of the parties gives up its identity. Either we become their servants, or the United States, as Imam Khomeini put it, stops acting so foolishly, stubbornly. As long as this is the case, there will be conflicts. We are by nature opposed to each other.
Mikhail Ulyanov, ambassador to the UN for Russia, one of Iran's two friends among JCPOA signatories, also welcomed the U.S.'s move to join talks. Now is the time for real politics and diplomacy, he said in a message to the U.S. The sooner you and your Iranian colleagues, as well as other JCPOA participants, start pragmatic discussions on the way out of the current unfortunate situation, the better. Yet another episode comes to an end, but the show goes on, as do nuclear deal discussions. So do return to the box at the same times next week and each week after. Thanks.
Our voice comes from the heart of beautiful Iran.
The debate.
UN Humanitarian Chief Mark Lowcock said 16 million people are going hungry across Yemen. This is while Yemen's Supreme Council for Management of Humanitarian Affairs says that Saudi-backed militants are using civilians and displaced people as human shields in the ongoing clashes in Yemen's city of Ma'arib. On Thursday, Ansarullah deployed troops to the city of Ma'arib, which is a stronghold of loyalists of the former Yemeni government. The Daesh terrorist group has also openly confirmed that its members are fighting alongside Saudi-backed mercenaries against Yemen's army and popular forces in the province of Ma'arib. Well, the country has been devastated by a war waged by Saudi Arabia and its allies since March 2015. The kingdom has also imposed an all-out blockade that has hampered aid imports to Yemen.
The fighting is escalating in the city of Ma'arib, which is the last stronghold of the Saudi-backed forces in the north of the war-torn country. On Thursday, the Ansarullah movement and allied army units ordered a wide deployment of troops to Ma'arib, saying the move is aimed at protecting Yemeni citizens. The deployment came as reports surfaced suggesting grave human rights violations by Riyadh loyalists. Yemen's Supreme Council for Management of Humanitarian Affairs said Saudi-backed militants are using civilians and displaced people as human shields in the ongoing clashes in Ma'arib. The council said Saudi Arabia and its allies bear responsibility for endangering civilian lives. Meanwhile, the Saudi-led coalition has also redeployed troops to the region and increased airstrikes against Ansarullah positions there. The United Nations has urged warring sides to stop their offensive on Ma'arib and called for an immediate ceasefire.
The attack on Ma'arib must stop. It puts millions of civilians at risk, as Mark has been commenting this week, and especially with the fighting threatening to reach the camps for internally displaced persons.
The UN also warned about a looming famine in Yemen, which the world body said would be the worst on the planet in decades due to years of war. UN Humanitarian Chief Mark Lowcock said 16 million people are going hungry across Yemen, including 5 million who are just one step away from famine. The UN official also highlighted the high records of malnutrition rate among Yemeni people. Yemen has been devastated by the war waged by Saudi Arabia, along with some of its regional allies and backed by the US and European countries, such as Britain and France in March 2015. The kingdom has conducted airstrikes on its southern impoverished neighbor almost on a daily basis. It has also imposed an all-out blockade that has hampered even humanitarian aid deliveries to Yemen. The new US administration has been making a fuss about ending the Saudi war on Yemen and ensuring that humanitarian aid reached the Yemeni people. Despite the claims, Washington has failed to take practical measures to push its major regional allies, Saudi Arabia and the United Arab Emirates, to end their deadly war against their conflict-plagued Arab country.
Well, joining us on this debate, we have Director of Human Rights for Yemen, Kim Sharif, joining us from the British capital, London. Also, we have manager at Canadian Defenders for Human Rights, Firas El Najem, joining us from Toronto. Welcome to the program, to the both of you. Let's start off with Ms. Sharif in London. Yemen's Supreme Council of Humanitarian Affairs has reported that Saudi-backed militants are using civilians and displaced people as human shields in the ongoing clashes in Yemen's city of Marib, and that Saudi Arabia and its allies bear responsibility for endangering civilian lives. Talk to us more about that also. That condemnation has not been echoed by the likes of the UN or the United States. And also, if you may, tell us why is the Marib battle so vital right now?
Well, good evening to you, and thank you for the invite to join the debate. Basically, the background to what's happening in Marib in particular is that the oil of Yemen was being stolen and continues to be stolen by the Western-backed Saudi coalition team and their mercenaries. And of course, the income from all that oil revenue was being diverted for the purchase of hotels, villas, and lots of other real estate properties in Cairo, in Istanbul, and even in London. I have seen evidence of that. Basically, what's happening is that the international community doesn't want the Yemen army and its popular committees to advance in Marib because it stands to lose a great deal of oil revenue that it's stealing from Yemen today. I'm not just making this claim. This matter was being investigated by the French authorities, I believe, about a year ago. We revealed that about 4 years ago that Yemen oil was being stolen in favor of the Saudi-led coalition via the French oil giant Total. And I believe that investigation is still ongoing. And that's one of the reasons why they don't want the Yemen army to advance in Marib. That's one point. The second point is, as your reporter has just confirmed, the most dangerous terrorist groups in the world, in Yemen today, are fighting alongside Saudi-led coalition forces. I'm glad they have finally come out and confirmed this. This was confirmed by BBC report Safa Ahmed. This was confirmed by CNN, whereby American weapons are ending up in the hands of ACAP and Daesh. This has been confirmed by what we found when we regained Al-Baida. We found nationalities from Chechnya, from Pakistan, from Afghanistan, from many other countries. All the known usual terrorists were there. Why? What are they doing in Al-Baida? They were brought in there by the Saudi-led coalition. They don't have ground forces. Their ground forces consist of terrorist outfits such as Daesh and ACAB, as well as mercenaries they get from Sudan, Senegal, and elsewhere. That's the other reason. They want Yemen to continue to have terrorism problems so that it can give the Americans and their allies the right to come and attack Yemen, as they have been doing for the past 6 years. So we don't have terrorism in the past controlled by Sana'a government by comparison. You will see that Sana'a government is the only one that's fighting terrorism in Yemen today.
Ms. Sharif, hold that thought. Let's bring in our guest from Toronto, Mr. Firas El Najem. The United Nations says that Yemen is speeding towards the worst famine on the planet. Top UN officials have also warned that this massive famine could wipe out any fresh peace efforts. The UN humanitarian chief, Mark Lowcock, said 16 million people are going hungry across Yemen. Yet we're still witnessing international inaction to relieve the suffering of the Yemeni people. Why has this war been dragged out for so long?
Well, you know, it's quite clear we want this war to keep dragging on and keep going because there's a plan behind it. And the U.S., and the British and the French are the ones giving all the logistical support to this war. Like, they're behind, and they have, you know, some of the strongest power inside the United Nations. And it's up to them to delay this war. It's up to them to stop this war. It's up to them to put sanctions against Saudi Arabia. We know Saudi Arabia is one of the biggest human rights violators in the whole Middle Eastern region. We know that they are a monarchy, tribal, tyrannical regime that does not respect human rights whatsoever. They don't have any human rights organizations operating inside their country. We see what they do to their own civilians in their country. We see what they do to any opposition members inside their country. We see what they do to other countries when you know, people stand up for their rights, such as Bahrain, and they intervened and they went there and they occupied that place as well. They've been committing massive amounts of human rights abuses and massacres, you know, war crimes in Yemen. We've been seeing it now. We're going into 6 years of a war, right? And we know it's obviously an illegitimate war from the beginning, because the Yemeni people rose up peacefully to change the system that's there. We've heard Mark speak before. We've heard Ban Ki-moon before, the former Secretary General of the United Nations, speaking about it's the worst famine, it's the worst humanitarian crisis. But what's been done? When has Saudi Arabia ever been, and their coalition, held accountable for all these human rights abuses and all these war crimes? Nothing. We hear it sometimes. One time there was a certain labeling of tribes by the United Nations, and then they pulled back and retracted that because of some bullying, because of some bribing, because of some blackmail. I mean, this is what the United Nations today. Today, United Nations is a tool for certain countries, and they can exercise the plans that they want and the projects they want. And then before they said, we'll pull out of the International Criminal Court, we won't even recognize them. We won't recognize the Human Rights Commission inside the United Nations. They said it was, you know, it's not operating right, so we just pull out. So pretty much we don't even care about what's happening within human rights in the United Nations. So it's a very biased system. It's a very unfair system. And, I mean, like, Yemen is the worst humanitarian crisis. We see the pictures every day. We've seen the famine. We've seen the children dying. Where is humanity? That's the question. Where is all these countries that are still ongoing and justifying supplying arms deals? You know, Canada, one of the countries that I'm living in here, our government here is supplying the biggest arms deal to Saudi Arabia continuously, and it's continuing, even though they know what's happening in Yemen.
Okay.
You know, this hypocrisy must stop, you know, and we as you...
Let's cross over back to London. Kim Sharif, U.S. President Joe Biden announced an end to U.S. support for the Saudi-led military offensive in Yemen, indicating that the new administration in Washington is planning a more active role in efforts to end the country's war and the crisis there. The question is, will Washington act on those comments? Because ending support doesn't mean that the war will just end.
Indeed. We have had nothing but total hypocrisy from the U.S. regime. I mean, Mr. Biden must be reminded that his administration was in charge when this aggression on Yemen was announced in Washington on 26 March 2015. And if it hadn't been for U.S.'s full backing, and I actually suspect a command to the Saudi-led coalition to put together this coalition and attack Yemen, this war wouldn't have started in the first place. There is no mandate from the UN to invite or to allow anyone to use force against Yemen. If it hadn't been for U.S. bullying and involvement, and as I said, I sincerely believe this is U.S.'s war, and this is Mr. Biden's attempt at trying to play the Mr. Nice diplomat now that they have failed miserably in occupying Yemen completely and colonizing it, which is what they wanted to do from the start. And now between Britain and the U.S., they're playing the good cop, the bad cop scenario on us, whereby Britain continues to supply weapons, but the U.S. will start to play the nice diplomat who is going to make every effort to stop. For God's sake, it's very straightforward. If he really is genuine about what he's saying, I put him to the test here by inviting Mr. Biden to go to the Security Council tomorrow and pass a resolution demanding forthwith cessation of hostilities against the state of Yemen by the Saudi-led coalition and forthwith lifting of the illegal blockade. And then I will believe him and trust him. But then meanwhile, While he continues to make these statements, look, we need to see action on the ground. We don't want empty statements and good cop, bad cop scenario won't work with us. Yes. Let's just face it. Saudi-led coalition have been defeated. They are using human civilians as a human shield in Marib, simply because they are terrified witless. Once Marib has returned to the sovereignty of the state of Yemen, that is basically the end of Saudi-led coalition. They will have no leg to stand in continuing their aggression against Yemen, which is why their Western backers are also making noises about Marib. They're saying all warring parties. What do you mean by all warring parties? This is an aggression by the US and the UK through Saudi-led coalition.
Mr. Al-Najim, I saw you nodding there, reacting to the news of Joe Biden's comments that the U.S. wants to stop its support for the Saudi aggression. Yemen's Supreme Political Council back then said that Yemenis will not be fooled by mere U.S. statements. They want to see action also. Why should the Yemenis even trust Washington? In fact, just as Ms. Sharif just mentioned, in 2015, it was the Obama administration, along with Mr. Biden, that gave Riyadh the support in the first place.
Yes, that's very clear, obviously, that Obama sparked this war at his time, and this person, Biden, is on the same system and same team, and he's gonna be, when he's promoting for his campaign, he's gonna try to use all kinds of different, marketing tools to get into power, that he's gonna stop this and stop that. But like, he came in right now, and we see now the war is intensifying in Marib and different areas. He could easily pull the plug on the Saudis and stop this war and stop the arms deal right ahead and adopt a resolution in the United Nations to stop the war, right? They got veto power inside the United Nations. So it's a very easy war. The Saudi regime itself is living on the oxygen tank of the American system and regime. So it's very quickly. The thing is, they just don't want resistance in the area. I would like to add to Kim's comment about how this is, it's also there to secure Israel. So it's a U.S.-Israeli war, pretty much. And it's there to secure the interest of securing Israel, because they know that Ansarullah are part of the axis or the unity of the resistance groups in the Middle East. And this all sparked at the time of 1979, where Imam Khomeini did his revolution, and he fought the colonial powers that they want to control the area, all these, Western countries that want to set up their bases and start wars and sell arms to these guys and plunder the resources of the region. And Ansarullah is part of that axis, and this is a very dangerous area because of Bab al-Mandab. Also, it's a water pathway that is needed for them to bring their ships and their, dock all their planes on there, their fighter jets, and bring in all their supplies to support Israel and to support the control and the bases of the region. So this is their main danger. They don't want a strong government, a sovereign government, a legitimate government. What is Ansarullah? Ansarullah has other political factions that are all Yemeni, and they're people that were inside the country. They didn't come from outside. There's not one Iranian person inside Iran, except maybe the ambassador that just recently got in there. So this is a very big joke whenever they say the Iranians are behind this, the Iranians are running the show. Where is the Iranians? You have not captured one Iranian. Have you had one prisoner of war that's Iranian till now, so you can even show some kind of credibility or even justify or even make up a scenario? They haven't even been able to make up a scenario where they find some Iranians, and do something like this. This shows that everything they're doing is illegitimate, it's fraudulent, it's all fake, and it's all evil. And the only way it's going to happen, I think, is by the Yemeni unity and their defense and their deterrence. Like, these guys are, they're powerful. Like, when Biden had to pull their name off the terrorist list, this shows how strong they are and how big of negotiators they're going to be in the future. So we believe that the Yemeni government, Ansarullah, and the Houthis are the victorious ones, and they will defeat all these coalitions.
Kim Sharif, we were talking about Joe Biden's campaign trail. On the campaign trail, Joe Biden said, and I quote, "We will in fact make the Saudis the pariah that they are, and they have to be held accountable for murdering children in Yemen." Well, the Saudis right now, they aren't even on the UN's child killer blacklist. What does that mean?
Well, it's quite right. I'm glad you make that quote, because these were quite a few of his quotes before the election. He made a mandate. He promised the people of the US that if he is voted into power, he will do these things. But so far, not so good. The one good thing he's done is obviously removing the designation that was quite irrational and frankly illegal and unworkable, because it's designating the entire Yemeni population as terrorists, which is impossible. The only terrorists in Yemen are those people working for them, ACAP and Daesh, as they have quite clearly made a statement yesterday confirming that. Joe Biden, I mean, I want to tell you about another important thing. He said he was going to care for children. What about women? Last couple of weeks, Saudi-led coalition mercenaries in Marib kidnapped 8 women, beaten them with the gun butts and pulled their hairs. One of them just gave birth 2 weeks earlier. They refused to let her take her child to breastfeed. One of the 8 women was tortured to death, and 7 of them were sold on to Saudi regime. That is human trafficking in a worst case scenario in the middle of this war. These women have done nothing. They were mere internally displaced people living in tents and places like that. And so Joe Biden, just like many other Western politicians, they say something, but then in reality, they do completely the opposite. And they always find good excuses to get away from it. At the moment, so far, it sounds like he has avoided speaking to Bin Salman. He hasn't spoken to him, and he made statements that if he is to deal with the Saudi regime, he's going to be communicating with Salman directly. And good luck to him, and know how to manage Alzheimer's situations. I hope he does. So he needs to do more than just say, I'm not going to be on speaking terms with this man who stands accused of brutally murdering Khashoggi in breach of all kinds of laws, laws of the heavens and laws of the earth, and disrespect to other people's jurisdictions and so forth. Mm-hmm. So we need to see more from Mr. Biden. Enough. He's now past the stage of election sound bites. He's now in power. He needs to act as the real president, right, and do the right thing and go and pass that resolution at the UN Security Council and deal with Sana'a government directly in the usual diplomatic channels, okay, because he will find them the best partners in the war against terror.
One last question for Mr. Al-Najim in Toronto before we leave. The Daesh terrorist group has openly confirmed that its members are fighting alongside the Saudi-backed mercenaries in Marib. A lot of other data points in the direction that the Saudi-led coalition and its mercenaries and even Washington have been fighting alongside Takfiri terror outfits such as Daesh and Al-Qaeda in Yemen. Share with us your thoughts on that issue before we leave.
Well, I mean, it's nothing shocking at all, because the Wahhabi state-sponsored doctrine of Saudi Arabia, that's their, you know, that's what they are, they're the Wahhabi sect. And the Wahhabi sect is the doctrine that's a deviant, and that is an extremist doctrine that has, you know, obviously is far away from the real Islam. And it's these people are working based on this doctrine right now, and they just don't have a government. So they're just, lawless people on the ground.
All right. We're fresh out of time of this program. Allow me to thank my guest, Director of Human Rights for Yemen, Ms. Kim Sharif, joining us from London. Also, thanks to manager at Canadian Defenders for Human Rights, Mr. Firas Al-Najim, speaking to us.